Support for Studio 360's podcast comes from Lumosity. You work out your body, but you might be ignoring your most important muscle, your brain. You can give your brain the workout it needs with a training program designed by the neuroscientists at Lumosity.com and used by researchers at Harvard, Berkeley, and Columbia universities. Learn more about achieving a brighter brain at Lumosity.com. And from Shutterstock.com, providing a searchable collection of 20 million high-resolution stock photos, illustrations, vectors, and video clips to integrate into creative projects. For a free trial and a special offer, go to Shutterstock.com/PRI.
Movie makers love nothing more than selling a good scare. But what subject spooks them?
Man and wife! Say man and wife!
Man and wife!
Today in Studio 360, I talk with one of America's leading film scholars about marriage in the movies.
A happy marriage settles into a routine that does not lend itself well to a two-hour movie.
Plus, choral music gets its first superstar contemporary composer. He's good-looking, Juilliard-trained, ambitious, and milking the 80s of his youth for all they're worth.
I personally feel like I can hear 80s pop. Even in my slow, luscious choral works, you can really hear the influence of Depeche Mode in there.
Eric Whitaker brings serious new choral music to the masses. That and more is ahead in this hour of Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion, helping others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. Scion's Motivate program helps young entrepreneurs take their businesses to the next level. This March, program finalists were provided mentors, met with advisors, and attended business seminars. Learn more at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
At this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq.
We went right into a battle that lasted probably about 45 minutes. It seemed to go on a lot longer.
10 years ago this week, we invaded Iraq.
The gunner was right above me, who was firing a 50 caliber, and the shells were falling down. You couldn't possibly hold a pen or a pencil straight during that kind of thing.
Later this hour, we'll hear more from Steve Mumford. His life was transformed when he went to Iraq to chronicle the war as a painter and illustrator. But first,
I'm Molly Halpern of the Bureau, and this is Wanted by the FBI. 13 pieces of art were stolen from Boston's Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum 23 years ago this month. Special agent.
We've talked on the show before about this $500 million art heist, the night some guys waltzed into Boston's Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum and stole 13 paintings and drawings, including work by Rembrandt, Vermeer, Manet. It happened 23 years ago this week, and the FBI used the anniversary to announce developments in the case. They say that a sale of the art was attempted in Philadelphia a decade ago, and that they know who the thieves are. Stephen Kirkjian works for the Boston Globe, where he has been covering this story practically from the start. Steve, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
So what was your reaction this week when the FBI made this somewhat odd announcement?
I knew the press conference was coming. I was told it was going to be some important announcement, but I was still stunned when I read the press release, which included the statement that said that they knew who the individuals were and there had been attempted fencing of the artwork 10 years ago in Philadelphia.
And based on your intimate knowledge of this case, and I presume knowing the federal investigators, do we presume this is a strategy beyond, like, people of the world, if you've seen the art, tell us about it. Is there some strategy going on in terms of the crooks whose identities they claim they know?
Well, you have to understand, they are not trying to write a story or they're not trying to make a movie here.
Sure,
they're trying
sure.
to get the artwork back. So they do it with a strategy. They say if they give out the details of the theft, including the names of those individuals, those people who know those individuals will start providing further information about them that they really don't need. They're focused solely, the investigators are focused solely, not on coming up with a more compelling account of who did what to whom the night of the robbery, but getting the artwork back. What they need now is the public's help in getting the stuff back, because they haven't had a credible location of this material for 10 years.
Right.
So imagine, it could have gone anywhere in the last 10 years.
Your Globe story this week describes how the FBI investigation intensified in 2010 after being very much on the back burner for a long time. Why did it intensify then?
They got a tip in 2010 that gave them some information as to the whereabouts of the artwork after it had been taken. My sense is that they know of a relationship between the thief and the person whom they got a tip from. This person may have been involved in the attempted fence. With that webbing, with that stitching, they say, there's something credible here.
I thought it was really interesting that in their announcements, the FBI essentially admitted that while the other nationally famous Boston case of the fugitive Whitey Bulger, the gangster, they were obsessing over, this took a sort of second position to that. What was the connection? Just a matter of resources, or is there some Whitey Bulger Gardner Museum connection?
Well, there's more of a mystique about Whitey Bulger in Boston. It's very intense of what he was able to learn or able to do. When there was another crime pulled off by another gang, Whitey was powerful enough to find those individuals who were responsible for the theft and exact a tribute, because this other gang had done a major heist in Whitey's territory. And that's, I think, what Whitey wanted to do here in 1990 after this theft came down. He wanted to find out who was involved and squeeze them for his tribute.
Uh-huh.
Or maybe even get the paintings for himself, so that, because the legend is they are, in fact, a get-out-of-jail-free card. Members at the time of Whitey's own gang said that, Whitey was interested in getting his tribute for that theft, but he was unsuccessful.
Well, and now the other connection, of course, is that they caught him in Los Angeles, in Southern California, 2 years ago, significantly through this sort of public information campaign.
Right.
That they're trying to do that again, I guess, with this, by putting up billboards and videos and stuff.
Right. And, that's true. It was very successful in Whitey's campaign, and I'm, hoping it's as successful here. I think the Rembrandts and Storm of the Sea of Galilee and the Vermeer, the concert, are pretty well known from anybody, who reads the paper. It's been in the paper for 23 years. But the other lesser works, they may be up in somebody's attic or in someone's trailer or something. And so why not? There are brothers and sisters and family members and friends who pass through that area all the time. And if they see it and they realize that I'm not going to get prosecuted for bringing this stuff back, and there may be a portion or a full $5 million reward, why not help out the feds?
Now, what's your best guess about what happens now? Is this going to get wrapped up in a year or two and we'll be talking again? Here's what happened. They got the guys. They got the art. It's all over.
I pray that's what happens, because I want a full account. I think Boston wants a full account. I think the interest of the nation, if not the world, wants a full account of what happened here. I'm not sure that the real tale will be as scintillating as our imaginations take us. But for a true Boston story, this you cannot touch it, because it connects both the high culture of this city with the criminal underworld. So I think that connection, that cross, that intersection, just brings so much power to the story.
So maybe we'll all be disappointed when it's finally solved.
Well, I won't be.
Stephen Kirkjian, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Kurt. Great to be on.
Steve Kirkjian is an investigative reporter for the Boston Globe. You can see pictures of the Gardner's stolen paintings at studio360.org. And anybody with information can contact the FBI at 1-800-CALL-FBI or online at tips.fbi.gov. Coming up in Studio 360, marriage can be tough sometimes in real life, but it's not too easy in the movies either.
To tell the marriage story, you need to wreck the marriage. To make a marriage movie, you have to kill the concept.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Marriage is for older folks. Old folks, not for me. One husband, one wife, what do you got to pay? people sentenced for life.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion, helping others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. Scion's Motivate program helps young entrepreneurs take their businesses to the next level. This March, program finalists were provided mentors, met with advisors, and attended business seminars. Learn more at scion.com.
I'm not ready to quit being free, and I'm not willing to stop.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
I wanted to discuss my marriage.
I'll bet not much makes a Hollywood executive in a pitch meeting want to say stop more than the word marriage. Movies are about the flirtation, the hot courtship, the comic mismatch, the embarrassing one-night stand, the one-night stand on the spaceship before time traveling into a wormhole, not waking up next to somebody every day for the rest of your life.
You were making some noises in the night, funny noises.
I always do, Lily. That is, you always say that I always do. How do I know?
You always do, but not this kind.
But there is a long and illustrious history of marriage movies, and it's chronicled in the new book I Do and I Don't. The book's author is Janine Basinger, a professor at Wesleyan University and one of the country's leading film historians.
Also, I have impeccable credentials here. I am married 45 years, going on 46, and people are frequently asking me, how do you manage to do that? And I, of course, have no answer. So I thought, you know, maybe I'll find it. I'll go and I'll look at all these marriage movies and suddenly I'll become a marriage expert.
Would your 45-year marriage make, was there anything there that could be transformed and transmuted into a good movie?
Well, of course not, because it's a happy marriage, and therefore, you know, there's no story arc. But you see, a happy marriage has nothing of interest. It's day to day, week to week, month to month, occasional bickering, occasional conflict, but it settles into a routine that does not lend itself well to a two-hour movie, and that's the interesting aspect.
Is there a movie that depicts marriage so wonderfully or accurately or whateverly that you would tell a couple thinking about marriage or just married to go look at that one?
No. You know, one of the things that I discovered and which made me think about my own marriage and about marriage movies that I learned was they do respect the kind of idea that there's a secret to every marriage. There's a mystery to every marriage. But there are marriage movies that I think tell stories about marriage that really echo an honesty. And one that I like a lot is a 1936 movie called Dodsworth. It's
sure.
a brilliant movie, really, for many reasons.
I don't seem to be able to strike the congenial note. I do think you might meet me halfway. After all, as I look back, I don't blame myself. I can't, really. You know, you were a good deal at fault, too.
It really shows that people can live together in marriage for a couple of decades, never really communicate, and never really understand each other.
Another movie you write about that really doesn't end well very much beyond the courtship is Blue Valentine, which came out a couple of years ago with Michelle Williams and Ryan Gosling. I want to play just a bit of that film.
Maybe we have to get out of this house. Let's go get drunk and make love. And do you want
Tina,
the Cupid's Cove, or do you want the future? Make a decision, baby, please.
I want to get in the car at 7:30.
What's interesting, what was interesting to me in doing all this research and looking at so many marriages over so many decades, and not just American movies but also foreign ones, was how the problems that are in marriage are the problems that are in marriage.
Huh.
You can change them like having frank sex scenes or whatever, but fundamentally they're the same. They're the same issues about class differences, compatibility, competition, in-laws, money, adultery, addiction, and of course my personal favorite, murder. one of the things that really captured my attention was how many marriage movies were about one mate trying to kill the other.
Uh-huh.
And if you think about it, you realize, well, sure. I mean, how many times do you say to your mate, listen, I'm going to kill you if you don't, you know, do this or if you don't do that or whatever. There's that anger and tension that's possible, and they turn it into a big issue and make it murder in A Marriage Story, which seemed to please audiences very much.
In the last 6 months or year, I can think of two big movies that got attention that were about marriage. This is 40. And then in a very different way, Michael Haneke's Amour. So what did you think of those two recent movie marriages?
I mean, Amour was a, for someone who's been married as many years as I have, who's moving into the older age, that was a tough movie to look at. But it's a beautiful story of a long-term commitment where they face, you know, the issues that couples face and have to make the tough decisions. I kind of wish you hadn't brought up This is 40, because if I'm going to be honest with you, maybe I won't be. I loved it. No, I hated that movie. I absolutely hated that movie.
Why did we fight?
I don't know. It makes no sense.
It makes no sense.
And you get so mad at me.
Oh, my
gosh. I feel like you want to kill me.
I do want to kill you.
But it does have the same issues. They have in-law problems. They have money problems. They have sex problems. They have competition problems. They have, you know, it's the same set of things. I found it uncharming. It didn't work well for me. Let me ask you if you liked it.
Well, actually, I was going to come back to you and say I'm one of the apparently few people of any intelligence who didn't love Amour, because I find it didn't tell me anything I hadn't already kind of seen, experienced, gamed through in my mind about what people in this terrible situation would be like.
Absolutely. By the way, This is 90 is what I dubbed it. I have to say that I was being very polite because I do feel it was beautifully done, but you didn't actually hear me say I loved it. You're absolutely right. It did not bring us anything terribly new in that regard.
Well, something else we agree about is the TV show Friday Night Lights. You say that Coach Taylor and his wife Tammy may be the best depiction of marriage in cinema, film, TV, anywhere.
First of all, I loved Friday Night Lights. I thought it was fabulous in every possible way. The marriage was particularly outstanding.
Can I help you make the decision?
Sure. Go ahead, make the decision, hon. What's your decision? You make the call.
Start Saracen.
Start Saracen? I cannot start Matt Saracen.
Start Voodoo.
I don't want to start Voodoo.
Start me.
I would love to start you.
You know, television can give you an honest marriage more easily than a movie. A movie's got to create a story arc. It's got to make a roller coaster ride out of what is essentially a merry-go-round ride. There's a great scene in that where she's struggling to get the garbage cans out to the curb, and he drives up, and he's full of himself and talking about his troubles as a coach, and she's wrestling these darn garbage cans. And finally, she just says, well, that's right. Don't help me. Then he feels terrible about it, and he starts trying to take the garbage cans. Now she won't let him. No, this is my – and then he's like, no, let me – and they start fighting over who's going to take the garbage cans out. You know, that's a marriage moment.
Mm-hmm.
It really is.
So as you were immersing and re-immersing in all these dozens, scores of marriage movies, did you watch them with your husband or alone?
Well – sometimes with him, he gets mighty tired of having to look at movies all the time. So he wanders in and out. Sometimes he sits down and watches them and gave an opinion. But, you know, here's the way you stay happily married. You don't make each other do each other's thing. If he wants to watch, I'm fine. If he doesn't want to watch, I'm fine. We let each other do the things that the other one is interested in.
Good advice. Wonderful wisdom. You've given me movies to watch. Janine Basinger, thank you very much.
It was my pleasure.
Janine Basinger is the author of I Do and I Don't, A History of Marriage in the Movies, as well as many other books about film. So, what is your favorite marriage in the movies? Go to studio360.org and let us know which one and why. We'll feature some of your choices on next week's show.
So you want to be in love like the movies, with a twinkle in their eyes. They're just saying their lines, and so we can't be in love like the movies. Now in the movies they make it look so perfect, and in the background they're always playing the right song, and in the ending resolution. But real life is more than just 2 hours long.
Benjamin Britten was one of the most popular composers of the 20th century. He wrote operas like Peter Grimes, one of my favorites, Billy Budd, he scored several films, and gave us The Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra. His work let him travel practically everywhere, but in middle age, Benjamin Britten returned to where he grew up, Suffolk, in the southeast of England.
After lunch, every afternoon, Benjamin Britten would go out walking, and during that walk, which was maybe an hour, maybe 90 minutes, he would consider and edit in his mind his morning's work on his compositions. It was a very important part of his compositional process.
That is Chris Watson. He's a composer of sorts, but his main thing is recording sounds from nature. He did sound for David Attenborough documentaries and other BBC projects. In honor of the Benjamin Britten centennial, which is this year, Watson spent months in the Suffolk countryside capturing the most important sounds in Britten's life.
I started off by just going down there and walking around the Suffolk countryside. And the wonderful thing is, the soundscape hasn't really changed much. So I was hearing very much the sounds that would have suffused Britten's thoughts as he was thinking about editing his work. Suffolk's a relatively low-lying English county, and it's relative. There's not much intensive agriculture by the coast, so it still retains this beautiful classic English countryside. It's a mosaic of habitats. It still has some of the original medieval field systems, old pathways and green tracks and holloways away from the beach. And these are the tracks and lanes which Britten would have taken. The soundscape has this seasonal aspect to it. So it starts in winter in old woodland and then moves in spring through to more deciduous and mixed woodland. And then in summer goes to the beautiful sort of Suffolk heathland. One of the most interesting things is there's several very particular signature sounds of that part of Suffolk. And one of them is the reed beds. Throughout the season, in these tall reeds, there's this really beautiful conversational papery hiss of reed stems rubbing together in the breeze. It sounds very simple, almost banal sound, but it's crucially important to one's sense of engagement with a habitat. It doesn't have much of a dynamic range, so it doesn't disturb or distract, but it's this constant harmonic ambient swish, effectively, upon which you can rest your thoughts. Throughout the seasons, there's lots of birdsong. Britten not only was a great composer, he was a great listener, because he was also a very keen ornithologist. The European nightingale has this astonishing song. That was Britten's favourite bird. As soon as I heard Britten's cello suites, I realised what I was hearing, not a mimicry of the song, but the pattern of phrasing and notes hinted very strongly to me of nightingales, which I featured prominently in the springtime part of the piece. A lot of the time with my work as a wildlife sound recordist, I try and get as close as possible to the subject to reduce the signal to ambient noise ratio. But on this occasion, I wasn't wanting it all from a microphone's position of hearing. I wanted it from Britten's point of hearing on a footpath. And so many of the sounds have this relatively distant perspective. All Britten's walks were within the sound shadow of the bells of Aldborough Parish Church, which is the churchyard, in fact, where Britten is laid to rest. You know, it confirmed my ideas that the spirit of place can be embodied in the soundscape of a place. And having to, you know, being able to spend, it was a real luxury and privilege, 18 months, you know, going back and recording in those places. What I do know, Benjamin Britten was a very private man, and his walks were crucially important to his work. He was incredibly creative musically, but he was a careful listener, as I like to think I am. I'm a wildlife sound recordist, you know, I listen for a living.
At studio360.org, you can hear Chris Watson's piece, In Britten's Footsteps, which was commissioned by the Aldborough Festival for the Benjamin Britten Centennial this year. Sarah Lilly produced our story. While we're on the subject of bird recordings, a couple of weeks ago, I gave you a challenge. We called it Remixing Spring. We posted a dozen bird songs recorded in the wild by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And I asked you to use them to create an original musical composition on the theme of spring. We got more than 100 pieces of new music from you. Classical, electronic, jazz, there's even a radio drama or two. We'd planned to announce the winner on this week's show, but there were so many great entries, we need a little extra time to judge them all. We'll reveal the winner in 2 weeks. Meantime, you can hear all 100-plus entries at studio360.org. Still ahead in this hour of Studio 360, Eric Whitaker is a Grammy Award-winning composer who has been at the top of the classical charts and brought ambitious choral music to new audiences, and created online virtual choruses composed of thousands of strangers all over the world. But he claims he'd give it all up in a heartbeat to be a roadie.
I'm still frankly waiting for Depeche Mode to call me. Even if they don't need a keyboard player, they've got to need somebody to carry their suitcases around. I'm here.
Eric Whitaker is next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion, helping others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. Scion's Motivate program helps young entrepreneurs take their businesses to the next level. This March, program finalists were provided mentors, met with advisors, and attended business seminars. Learn more at scion.com. Support for Studio 360's podcast comes from Lumosity. You work out your body, but you might be ignoring your most important muscle, your brain. You can give your brain the workout it needs with a training program designed by the neuroscientists at Lumosity.com and used by researchers at Harvard, Berkeley, and Columbia universities. Learn more about achieving a brighter brain at Lumosity.com. And from Shutterstock.com, a global image marketplace on the web. Shutterstock.com helps creative people find images or videos for their next creative project. Shutterstock offers a collection of over 20 million high-resolution stock photos, illustrations, vectors, and video clips, and is searchable by subject, emotion, and other features. Any image in any size is available for one price. For a free trial and a special offer for our listeners, go to shutterstock.com/PRI.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Choral music sometimes gets a bad rap for being stuffy, boring, old, but Eric Whitaker is changing that. He's the closest thing choir nerds have ever had to a rock star. Whitaker is a classical music phenomenon who's created some of the most popular choral music since I don't know when. Right now, he's a composer in residence at Cambridge University in the UK, and his ensemble, the Eric Whitaker Singers, just finished their first U.S. tour. But his single most celebrated and unusual success has been online, where he's organized several virtual choirs consisting of thousands of people all over the world. He got the idea from a teenager in Long Island.
So this young woman named Britlin Losey uploaded a video of herself to YouTube, singing just the soprano part to a piece that I'd written called Sleep. It was kind of a fan video that she made to me. I saw it, and I had this idea that if I could get other people around the world to do what she's doing, sit alone in their room and sing their part, but sing it in the exact same tempo, and then they all uploaded this to YouTube, and we started all those videos at the same time, it would have to make a choir. It would have to make a virtual choir. And so we tried it. The hardest part was getting them to sing together. So I uploaded a track of my own with me conducting so that each singer would follow it.
And do you use every video that people upload, or do you pick and choose?
Every single video. There's no audition process. The first video that we made had 185 singers from 12 different countries, and it went viral. We've since done Virtual Choir 2, Virtual Choir 3, which had nearly 4,000 singers from 73 countries.
So you're like a cult leader now.
No.
And now that you've done it three times, is the experience of having done the others, has it led you to write the fourth one differently? And what's it going to be?
Yes, radically different. So not only will, for the first time, are we going to use a click track for the recording, so that we can even further line up the singers. But I've changed the text that I'm using. So, for instance, the second one that we did, Sleep, which had beautiful poetry by poet Charles Anthony Silvestri, meditated on this word sleep over and over and over. Well, you can imagine sleep, sleep. You've got 2,000 people all doing that S at the same time. It's a nightmare trying to line up and clean up the audio for that.
Yeah.
So Virtual Choir 4 will have no consonants and certainly no sibilants. And then the click track, we're going to this time add an electronica component so that there's electronic dance music underneath it. And then that will be open for DJs around the world to remix, so that we're going to try to open the project to other kinds of musicians as well to be a part of it.
How interesting and smart. And what's it called?
It's called Bliss. But the choir will never actually say the word Bliss.
I was going to say, so the sibilance you put in the title but not in the words.
Yeah, exactly.
Choral music is different than music for instrumental groups in a lot of ways, one of them being that there are lots more community and church choirs and amateur choral singers and novice groups. When you compose, imagining that all kinds of groups will sing your music, do you keep that in mind, that these aren't all going to be professional singers?
I do, absolutely. I'm consciously aware of every note that I write that somebody somewhere is going to be trying to deal with this. And one of the things that I'll do as a composer is I'll sing through all of the lines, the soprano lines, the alto lines, tenor lines, even though I'm not such a great singer, I'll sing through them just to see, do they feel singable? Do they feel ergonomic to the voice? And also, are they a pleasure to sing? Is it something, you know, I try to imagine this alto somewhere in the world just enjoying her part, saying, yeah, that feels nice.
So you really are kind of a, it seems like, hardwired populist, despite your Juilliard training and Cambridge University residency and all these hoity-toity parts of your resume.
Yeah, I suppose so.
And speaking of populism, you grew up in the 1980s, and I am told that you are still a big 80s English pop rock fan and still listen to Duran Duran and Depeche Mode.
Just this morning I was listening to Duran Duran and Depeche Mode. I'm still frankly waiting for Depeche Mode to call me. I know even if they don't need a keyboard player, they've got to need somebody to carry their suitcases around. I'm here.
Favorite songs?
Well, in fact, one of my all-time favorite songs is the Depeche Mode 1990 single, Enjoy the Silence. And I've arranged it for my choir. We're going to premiere it for the first time on this East Coast tour that we're doing next week.
I may have to go just to hear that, because to me, Depeche Mode 20 years, 30 years later, and Duran Duran for that matter, come across as a little cheesy sometimes.
I know, but the thing is, you know, like any good standard, it's all about the melody and the lyrics. And some of these songs, I think they're dated because they're using 80s synths and drum machines.
Mm-hmm.
But the songs themselves are poignant and genuinely moving. I personally feel like I can hear 80s pop in my even in my, you know, the slow, luscious choral works. And also I know some of my pieces, if I just sit at the piano and play them bare bones and play them in the style of 80s pop, that you can really hear the influence of Depeche Mode in there.
And you say you're not a good singer, but you started singing in college. Tell me about that and how that led to what you now do.
I did. I was 18 years old. I was a freshman at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. And a friend of mine said that I should join choir because there were a lot of cute girls in the soprano section. And I had seen choirs in high school. I thought they were the biggest geeks in the world. There was no way I was going to do this. But then they also said that there was this free trip to Mexico at the end of the year in the choir. And I thought, okay, for girls in Mexico, I could do it. And on the very first day of rehearsal, we sang the Kyrie from the Requiem by Mozart. And 50 minutes later, I left that room a completely, utterly transformed human being. It changed my life completely.
That was your aha moment. Let's play a little bit of the Kyrie from Mozart's Requiem. And I want you to explain to me what struck you about singing it and transformed you. And feel
Do you want me to talk while the music is happening?
Absolutely.
Okay. Okay, so right away, the basses are singing, so that was me. Here comes the altos. This is called a fugue. So there's a subject and a counter subject. Now the sopranos get the subject again. Tenors get the counter subject. So now you've got four parts. It's like this cosmic Swiss watch. It's this impossibly elegant, delicate, brilliant motor that is happening in three dimensions around you in the room. And it's intoxicating. I'll never forget that first day. It was happening around me and in my body, and I started giggling, and then I started trembling, and finally I had tears in my eyes. Just the most beautiful thing I'd ever heard. All I knew is I just needed more of it. So I joined the Men's Glee Club. I joined the Chamber Choir. I became president of the Choir Social Club. I just inundated myself with it. And then in my third year, when I was 21 years old, I decided to write my very first piece and a little piece called Go Lovely Rose as a gift to this conductor who had changed my life. And then that piece was published. And then I wrote another piece called Cloudburst. And that piece was published. And I sort of woke up one day and was a choral composer.
And had you studied composition in college?
Not at all, really. I really didn't study composition in my undergraduate degree. I did a little bit, but I did a 7-year undergraduate degree. Frankly, for the first 4 or 5 years, I could barely read music. And so a lot of it was just by ear and trial by error. And then finally, when I did my master's degree at the Juilliard School, that's when I had some real proper study with John Corleano.
One sound that comes up a lot in your music is something that I've learned is called a tone cluster, which is when the voices are singing a chord, but there's this hint of dissonance. I want to play an example from your piece Oculi Omnium to illustrate this. Can you explain to us what a tone cluster is?
Yeah, so normally there's a triad. Dum, 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 dum. And any note that's included from the scale that's not in that triad starts to turn it into a cluster. What I tend to do is I tend to load those things up in my music. So I might use, let's say, a scale. Actually, coming up, this is a great example of a tone cluster here. So basically, you've got seven notes of a scale there, and each of the notes are being held by a different group of singers in the choir. To me, it creates this shimmer, this harmonic cloud over the top of the music. To me, it sounds like the music is resolving and suspending at the same time. It's moving at the speed of light and not going anywhere.
Uh-huh.
And it's just my favorite sound in all the world, and I fill my music with it.
Yes, you do. So, despite your education and your erudition, you are not a snob. You write this beautiful, romantic, cinematic music. You have this great radio voice. You are, a beautiful man, let's be frank, with his long blonde hair, could appear on romance book covers. Does that package ever, do you think, hurt you professionally, make people think, oh, this guy can't be serious?
Oh, God. No, I don't know. I don't know. Like I told you, I just try to do what I do as honestly and genuinely as I possibly can, and then hope that the music finds its way.
Do people ever criticize you, hate on you for being too romantic?
Yeah, sometimes you hear that, you know, especially from the hardcore establishment. But, you know, what are you going to do? It's I just try to write music that I think is honest. And after that, I guess it'll always be critics.
People in the classical music world are always moaning worriedly about the aging of the audience. You seem not to have that problem. Your audiences are younger than the average. Is that not right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, for instance, on my Facebook fan page, the vast majority of people are 18 to 30 years old. Part of that has to do with some of my music is popular in the educational world. So it's performed in high schools and colleges.
It's kind of the Glee effect?
Yeah, exactly. And then part of it is I think that I try to be incredibly approachable on the web. So I've got a real Facebook and YouTube and Twitter presence. And I answer as many people as I possibly can personally. I think then younger people get talking and say, hey, this isn't so dusty.
Well, it sounds like what you're doing, entirely apart from the music, is something that the classical music world could learn from. And I'm wondering, is some next step for you to run a symphony orchestra somewhere?
Oh, wow. Yeah, something like that might be interesting, actually, now that you mention it. Weirdly, I'm starting to do more and more guest conducting of orchestras, and I adore it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in a way it's a little too limiting just being in that one orchestra. To me, the more exciting venue is the internet. And I think with the virtual choir, for instance, we're trying as hard as we can to push the technology so that I'm hoping very soon we'll be able to sing in real time. At the TED conference 2 weeks ago, I closed the conference with 100 live singers on stage, but then 32 people live beaming in from 32 different countries over Skype. And it worked. There was less than half a second delay from the live musicians. So my hope is that very soon, you know, I'll be able to pull out my iPhone 8 in Grand Central Station and start conducting Beethoven 9, and 1,000 people can just join in on their lunch hour from their phones.
And you'll be running Planet Earth Symphony Orchestra, I guess.
Yeah.
Eric Whitaker, thank you very much.
It is truly an honor. Thank you, Kurt.
You can hear a track from the latest Eric Whitaker album at studio360.org. And while you're there, you can also check out his first virtual choir performing Lux Aurumque. We're kind of compulsive when it comes to asking artists and other listeners about works of art that change their lives. Today, we'll hear from the painter Steve Mumford. When he was in art school, he struggled to find a style that felt like the right fit for him. He felt especially untalented in his attempts at abstract art.
And right about at that point, I found Winslow Homer's Civil War paintings.
Mumford was visiting one of the galleries at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. He discovered that when Winslow Homer was in his 20s in the 1860s, he got illustration assignments from Harper's Weekly to cover the Civil War.
Harper sent him as a combat artist, or what they called a special artist, to the Civil War. This was the days before photography, or at least before the common use of photography in magazines. After the war, he spent many years making paintings about his experiences. That's the work that I discovered in the Metropolitan. There was a painting that I absolutely fell in love with called The Camp. And it's a camp scene in the rain, so it's kind of this gloomy skies. As far as the eye can see, there's tents, lines of horses, and then a cluster of, I don't know, maybe eight guys around a fire, kind of huddled in their rain gear. And then off to the right is this forlorn-looking donkey who's tied to a pole that has some whip marks on his side. And he looks like he's really miserable. And in fact, the whole thing, it's this odd combination of miserable but kind of a quiet, almost cozy moment. And it's one of those moments in between the action. In his paintings, I think there's only one actual scene of combat. Most of them are about camp life and about this combination of kind of loneliness and camaraderie and the sort of sense of life being on hold while you're waiting to get back in the world. That's very, very powerful and not romantic. And that's what directly inspired me to go to Iraq as an artist. I made 6 trips, ranging from about a month and a half to almost 6 months, starting in 2003, right after the invasion, up until 2008. As a matter of fact, every time I'd arrive in Iraq, you know, you'd have to go and check in with the public affairs officer in the Green Zone in Baghdad. And they'd be like, oh, who are you with, CNN, Time? I'd say ArtNet. And the whole room would go silent. There'd be half a dozen people sitting around. And after a few seconds of silence, somebody would say, oh yeah, ArtNet, I know them. I think they just said it for my benefit. I think of Iraq, my experience in Iraq, as being more of a war zone than out-and-out combat. Most of that time was relatively peaceful. However, that said, you can't be in Iraq that long without stumbling into some bad situations, and I certainly did. I remember getting to Bakuba in, I think it was June of 2004. The next morning, I went to the Tactical Operations Center, and everything was crazy. I realized something was up, and it turned out that early that morning, insurgents had taken over the entire town, and we went right into a battle that lasted probably about 45 minutes. It seemed to go on a lot longer. The gunner was right above me, who was firing a 50 caliber, and the shells were falling down. They kept, one of them went down my back. I thought I was hit. It was so hot. But the vehicle I was in was hit with 2 rocket-propelled grenades, and there was lots and lots of gunfire. And all the guys that were firing out of the hatch were knocked out, and they were out for a few minutes, but the driver was okay, and he was able to keep the track going. Things like that would sometimes happen, and they were not, as it turned out, really useful as an artist. It was way too loud and way too, you couldn't possibly hold a pen or a pencil straight during that kind of thing. So as far as my productivity as an artist, it was really more the spaces in between the bombs rather than bullets actually flying in the drawing. In 2006, it was during the surge, in the Baghdad ER, where I spent 3 weeks, it was tough because people were coming in every day in helicopters that were really badly wounded. And in the end, actually didn't take very long for the doctors and nurses to really be appreciative of the fact that I was drawing everything that they were doing. One doc came up to me and his eyes teared up, and he said how meaningful it was to him that I was there making some drawings of what their daily experience was. I certainly thought a lot about Winslow Homer when I was in Iraq. The attitudes of the people that he paints and draws, the positions that they're in, just simply look so much like soldiers that I saw all the time in tiny bases and small towns in Iraq. So Homer's work was immensely present for me. When the editors at Harper's noticed my work in Iraq, Stacy Clarkson, the art editor, called me and said, will you be interested in us doing a portfolio of your work? And of course, she was very conscious of the Winslow Homer connection. What I was doing was basically the same thing that Winslow Homer was doing in the field during the Civil War. And so seeing that connection, they saw it as an opportunity to do sort of an updated version. Winslow Homer's work was, in retrospect, a sort of touchstone that I periodically came back to. There's, most of all, a lack of sentimentality in Homer's work. That lack of sentimentality was something that got him a fair amount of criticism from critics at the day, who felt that he was too realistic, who felt that he had not made his topics noble enough somehow. But it was exactly that insistence that he had on being true to not just what he saw, but the spirit of what he saw, that makes the work seem so contemporary today. And it's certainly something that I strive for in my drawings and also in my paintings.
Steve Mumford's story was produced by Mooj Zaidi. On our website, you can see a slideshow of Mumford's work from Iraq and the Winslow Homer painting that inspired him to go. Is there a painting or novel or any other work of art that's changed your life? If so, tell us your story at studio360.org. We might put you on the air. And that's it for this hour of Studio 360. Thank you very much for listening. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Alana Harper,
Shannon Geis,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Ruth Samuelson.
Thanks to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum. You can follow us on Twitter at Studio360Show and or me at KB Anderson. That's Anderson with an E. You can also find us on Facebook.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion, helping others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. Scion's Motivate program helps young entrepreneurs take their businesses to the next level. This March, program finalists were provided mentors, met with advisors, and attended business seminars. Learn more at scion.com. Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, we'll talk about a little book written 90 years ago. It's an easy read.
You feel like you're eating whipped cream.
But it's still the last word on the American dream.
It was the miracle of American literature.
People will talk about Gatsby as a figure. He was a real Gatsby, we'll say.
The Great Gatsby, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.